hit it again. How many times? I don't know. We just kept slamming into it, and every time we did, another jolt of pain would go up my leg, and things would get a little bit darker. At last, I looked up, blearily, and saw that the air outside the door seemed full of blood. But it wasn't blood. It was a pulsing red light reflecting off the falling snow. People were rattling at the door out there.
"Is it good enough?"
Lee asked me. I looked at Christine, only it wasn't Christine anymore. It was a spread-out pile of twisted, gored metal, puffs of upholstery, and glittering, broken glass. "Have to be," I said. "Let them in, Lee." And while she went, I fainted again. Then there were a series of confused images, things that came into focus for a while and then faded or disappeared completely. I can remember a stretcher being rolled out of the back of an ambulance. I can remember its sides being folded up and how the overhead fluorescence put cold highlights on its chrome. I can remember someone saying, "Cut it, you have to cut it off so we can at least look at it." I can remember someone else, Lee, I think, saying, "Don't hurt him, please, don't hurt him if you can help it." I can remember the roof of an ambulance. It had to be an ambulance because at the periphery of my vision were two suspended IV bottles. I can remember a cool swab of antiseptic and then the sting of a needle. After that, things became exceedingly weird. I knew somewhere deep inside that I was not dreaming. The pain proved that, if it proved nothing else. But all of it seemed like a dream. I was pretty well doped, and that was part of it. But shock was part of it, too. No fake, Jake. My mother was there, crying, in a room that looked sickeningly like the hospital room in which I had spent the entire autumn. Then my father was there, and Lee's dad was with him, and their faces were both so tight and grim, they looked like Tweedledum and Tweedledee, as Franz Kafka might have written them. My father bent over me and said in a voice like thunder, reverberating through cotton batting, "How did Michael get there, Dennis?" That's what they really wanted to know, how Michael got there. Oh, I thought. Oh, my friends, I could tell you stories. Then Mr. Cabot was saying, "What did you get my daughter into, boy?" I seemed to remember replying, "It's not what I got her into. It's what she got you out of," which I still think was pretty witty under the circumstances, doped up the way I was and all. Elaine was there briefly, and she seemed to be holding a yodel or a Twinkie or something mockingly out of my reach. Lee was there, holding her filmy nylon scarf out and asking me to raise my arm so she could tie it on. But I couldn't. My arm was like a lead bar. Then Arnie was there. And of course that had to be a dream. "Thanks, man," he said. And I noticed with something like terror that the left lens of his glasses was shattered. His face was okay, but that broken lens, it scared me.
"Thanks. You did okay. I feel better now. I think things are gonna be okay now."
"No sweat, Arnie," I said, or tried to say. But he was gone. It was the next day, not the 20th, but Sunday, January 21st, that I started to come back a little. My left leg was in a cast, up in its old familiar position again, amid all the pulleys and weights. There was a man I had never seen before, sitting to the left of my bed, reading a paperback John D. MacDonald story. He saw me looking at him and lowered his book. "Welcome back to the land of the living, Dennis," he said mildly, and deliberately marked his place in the book with a matchbook cover. He put the book in his lap and folded his hands over it.
"Are you a doctor?" I asked.
He sure wasn't Dr. Arroway, who had taken care of me last time. This guy was 20 years younger and at least 50 pounds leaner. He looked tough.
"State Police Inspector," he said. "Richard Mercer is my name. Rick, if you like."
He held out his hand, and stretching awkwardly and carefully, I touched it. I couldn't really shake it. My head ached, and I was thirsty.
"Look," I said, "I don't really mind talking to you.
and I'll answer all of your questions, but I'd like to see a doctor. I swallowed. He looked at me, concerned, and I blurted out, I need to know if I'm ever going to walk again.
If what that fellow Arroway says is the truth, Mercer said, you'll be able to get around in 4 to 6 weeks. You didn't break it again, Dennis. You severely strained it. That was what he said. It swelled up like a sausage. He also said you were lucky to get off so cheap.
What about Arnie? I asked. Arnie Cunningham? Do you know?
His eyes flickered.
What is it? I asked. What is it about Arnie?
Dennis, he said, and then hesitated. I don't know if this is the time.
Please, is Arnie... Is he dead?
Mercer sighed. Yes. He's dead. He and his mother had an accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike in the snow. If it was an accident. I tried to talk and couldn't. I motioned for the pitcher of water on the bed table, thinking how dismal it was to be in a hospital room and know exactly where everything was. Mercer poured me a glass and put the straw with the elbow bend in it. I drank, and it got a little bit better. My throat, that is. Nothing else seemed better at all.
What do you mean, if it was an accident?
Mercer said, it was Friday evening, and the snow just wasn't that heavy. The turnpike classification was 2, bare and wet, reduced visibility, use appropriate caution. We guess from the force of impact that they weren't doing much more than 45. The car veered across the median and struck a semi. It was Mrs. Cunningham's Volvo wagon. It exploded.
I closed my eyes. Regina?
Also DOA. For whatever it's worth, they probably didn't
suffer, I finished.
Bullshit.
They suffered plenty.
I felt tears and choked them back. Mercer said nothing.
All 3 of them, I muttered. Oh, Jesus Christ. All 3.
The driver of the truck broke his arm. That was the worst of it for him. He said that there were 3 people in the car, Dennis.
3?
Yes. And he said they appeared to be struggling.
Mercer looked at me frankly.
We're going on the theory that they picked up a bad news hitchhiker who escaped after the accident and before the troopers arrived.
But that was ridiculous. If you knew Regina Cunningham, I thought, she would no more pick up a hitchhiker than she would wear slacks to a faculty tee. The things you did and those you never did were firmly set in Regina Cunningham's mind, as if in cement, you could say. It had been LeBay. He couldn't be both places at once. That was the thing. And at the end, when he saw how things were going in Darnell's garage, he had abandoned Christine and had tried to go back to Arnie. What had happened then was anyone's guess. But I thought then, and I do now, that Arnie fought him and earned at least a draw.
Dead, I said.
And now the tears did come. I was too weak and low to stop them. I hadn't been able to keep him from getting killed, after all. Not the last time. Not when it really mattered. Others, maybe. But not Arnie. Tell me what happened, Mercer said. He put his book on the bed table and leaned forward. Tell me everything you know, Dennis. From first to last.
What has Lee said? I asked. And how is she?
She spent Friday night here under observation, Mercer told me. She had a concussion and a scalp laceration that took 12 stitches to close. No marks on her face. Lucky. She's a very pretty girl.
She's more than that, I said. She's beautiful.
She won't say anything, Mercer said, and a reluctant grin of admiration, I think, slanted his face to the left. Not to me, not to her father. He is, shall we say, in a state of high piss-off about the whole thing. She says it's your business what to tell and when to tell.
He looked at me thoughtfully.
Because, she says, you're the one who ended it.
I didn't do such a great job, I muttered. I was still trying to cope with the idea that Arnie could possibly be dead. It was impossible, wasn't it? We had gone to Camp Winesco in Vermont together when we were 12, and I got homesick and told him I was going to call and tell my parents they had to come get me. Arnie said if I did, he'd tell everybody at school that the reason I came home early was that they caught me eating boogers in my bunk after lights out and expelled me. We climbed the tree in my backyard to the very top fork and carved our initials there. He used to sleep over at my house, and we'd stay up late watching shock theater, crouched together on the sofa under an old quilt. We ate all those clandestine Wonder Bread sandwiches. When he was 14, Arnie came to me, scared and ashamed, because he was having these sexy dreams, and he thought they were making him wet the bed. But it was the ant farms my mind kept coming back to. How could he be dead when we had made those ant farms together? Dear Christ, it seemed like only a week or two ago, those ant farms. So how could he be dead? I opened my mouth to tell Mercer that Arnie couldn't be dead. Those ant farms made the very idea absurd. Then I closed my mouth again. I couldn't tell him that. He was just a guy. Arnie, I thought. Hey, man. It's not true, is it? Jesus Christ, we still got too much to do. We never even double-tated at the drive-in yet.
What happened? Mercer asked again. Tell me, Dennis.
You'd never believe it, I said thickly.
You might be surprised what I'd believe, he said. And you might be surprised what we know. A fellow named Junkins was the chief investigator on this case. He was killed not so very far from here. He was a good friend of mine. A good friend. A week before he died, he told me that he thought something was going on in Libertyville that nobody would believe. Then he was killed. With me? That makes it personal.
I shifted positions cautiously. He didn't tell you any more?
He told me that he believed he had uncovered an old murder, Mercer said, still not taking his eyes from mine. But it didn't much matter, he said, because the perpetrator was dead.
LeBay, I muttered, and thought that if Junkins had known about that, it was no wonder Christine had killed him. Because if Junkins had known that, he had been much too close to the whole truth.
Mercer said, LeBay was the name he mentioned. He leaned closer. And I'll tell you something else, Dennis. Junkins was one hell of a driver. When he was younger, before he got married, he used to run stockers at Philly Plains, and he won his share of checkered flags. He went off the road doing better than 120 in a Dodge Cruiser with a Hemi engine. Whoever was chasing him, and we know someone was, had to be one hell of a driver.
Yeah, I said. He was.
I came by myself. I've been here for 2 hours waiting for you to wake up. I was here until they kicked me out last night. I don't have a stenographer with me, I don't have a tape recorder, and I assure you that I'm not wearing a wire. When you make a statement, if you ever have to, that'll be a different ballgame. But for now, it's you and me. I have to know. Because I see Rudy Junkins' wife and Rudy Junkinson's kids from time to time. You dig?
I thought it over. For a long time, I thought it over. Nearly 5 minutes. He sat there and let me do it. At last, I nodded.
Okay. But you're still not gonna believe it. We'll see, he said.
I opened my mouth with no idea of what was gonna come out.
He was a loser, you know, I said. Every high school has to have at least two. It's like a national law. Everyone's dumping ground, only sometimes. Sometimes they find something to hold on to, and they survive. Arnie had me. And then he had Christine. I looked at him,
and if I had seen the slightest wrong flicker in those gray eyes that were so unsettlingly like Arnie's, well, if I had seen that, I think I would have clammed up right there and told him to put it on his books in whatever way seemed the most plausible, and to tell Rudy Junkins' kids whatever the hell he pleased. But he only nodded, watching me closely.
"I just wanted you to understand that," I said. And then a lump rose in my throat, and I couldn't say what I maybe should have said next. Lee Cabot came later. I drank some more water and swallowed hard. I talked for the next 2 hours. At last, I finished. There was no big climax. I simply dried up, my throat sore from so much talking. I didn't ask if he believed me. I didn't ask if he was going to have me locked up in a loony bin or give me a liar's medal. I knew that he believed a great deal of it, because what I knew dovetailed too well with what he knew. What he thought about the rest of it, Christine and LeBay and the past reaching out its hands toward the present, that I didn't know. And don't to this day. Not really. A little silence fell between us. At last he slapped his hands down on his thighs with a brisk sound and got to his feet.
"Well," he said, "your folks will be waiting to visit you, no doubt."
"Probably, yeah."
He took out his wallet and produced a small white business card with his name and number on it.
"I can usually be reached here, or someone will throw me a relay. When you speak to Lee Cabot again, would you tell her what you've told me and ask her to get in touch?"
"Yes, if you want, I'll do that."
"Will she corroborate your story?"
"Yes."
He looked at me fixedly.
"I'll tell you this much, Dennis," he said. "If you're lying, you don't know you are."
He left. I only saw him once more, and that was at the triple funeral for Arnie and his parents. The papers reported a tragic and bizarre fairy tale. Father killed in driveway car accident while mother and son are killed on Pennsylvania Turnpike. Paul Harvey used it on his program. No mention was made of Christine's being at Darnell's garage. My family came to visit that night, and by then I was feeling much easier in my mind. Part of it was bearing my bosom to Mercer, I think. He was what one of my psych profs in college called an interested outsider, the sort it's often easiest to talk to. But a great lot of the way I felt was due to a flying late-afternoon visit by Dr. Arroway. He was out of temper and irascible with me, suggesting that next time I just take a chainsaw to the goddamn leg and save us all a lot of time and trouble. But he also informed me, grudgingly, I think, that no lasting damage had been done. He thought. He warned me that I had not improved my chances of ever running in the Boston Marathon, and left. So the family visit was a gay one, due mostly to Ellie, who prattled on and on about that upcoming cataclysm, her first date. A pimply, bullet-headed nerd named Brandon Hurling had invited her to go roller skating with him. My dad was going to drive them. Pretty cool. My mother and father joined in, but my mother kept throwing anxious, "don't forget" glances at Dad, and he lingered after Mom had taken Elaine out.
"What happened?" he asked me. "Lee told her father some crazy story about cars driving themselves and little girls who were dead and I don't know what all. He's damn near wild."
I nodded. I was tired, but I didn't want Lee catching hell from her folks, or have them thinking she was either lying or nuts. If she was going to cover me with Mercer, I would have to cover her with her mother and father.
"All right," I said. "It's a bit of a story. You want to send Mom and Ellie around for a malt or something? Or maybe you better tell them to go to a movie."
"That long?"
"Yeah, that long."
He looked at me, his gaze troubled.
"Okay,"
he said. Shortly after, I told my story a second time. Now, I've told it a third. And third time, so they say, pays for all.
Rest in peace, Arnie.
I love you, man.
Epilogue. I guess if this was a made-up story, I would end it by telling you how the broken-legged knight of Darnell's garage wooed and won the lady fair, she of the pink nylon scarf and the arrogant Nordic cheekbones. But that never happened. Lee Cabot is Lee Ackerman now. She's in Taos, New Mexico, married to an IBM customer service rep. She sells Amway in her spare time. She has two little girls, identical twins, so I guess she probably doesn't have all that much spare time. I keep up on her doings after a fashion. My affection for the lady never really faded. We trade cards at Christmas, and I also send her a card on her birthday because she never forgets mine. That sort of thing. There are times when it seems a lot longer than 4 years. What happened to us? I don't really know. We went together for 2 years, slept together very satisfactorily, went to school together, drew, and were friends with each other. Her father shut up about our crazy story after my father talked with him, although he always regarded me after that as something of a dubious person. I think that both he and Mrs. Cabot were relieved when Lee and I went our separate ways. I could feel it when we started to drift apart, and it hurt me. It hurt a lot. I craved her in a way you continue to crave some substance on which you have no more physical dependency. Candy, tobacco, Coca-Cola. I carried a torch for her. But I'm afraid I carried it self-consciously, and dropped it with an almost unseemly haste. And maybe I do know what happened. What happened that night in Darnell's garage was a secret between us. And of course, lovers need their secrets, but this wasn't a good one to have. It was something cold and unnatural, something that smacked of madness and worse than madness. It smacked of the grave. There were nights after love when we would lie together in bed, naked, belly to belly, and that thing would be between us. Roland D. LeBay's face. I would be kissing her mouth, or her breasts, or her belly, warm with rising passion, and I would suddenly hear his voice. "That's about the finest smell in the world. Except for pussy." And I would freeze, my passion all steam and ashes. There were times, God knows, when I could see it in her face as well. The lovers don't always live happily ever after, even when they've done what seemed right, as well as they could do it. That's something else it took 4 years to learn. So we drifted apart. A secret needs two faces to bounce between. A secret needs to see itself in another pair of eyes. And although I did love her, all the kisses, all the endearments, all the walks arm in arm through blowing October leaves, none of those things could quite measure up to that magnificently simple act of tying her scarf around my arm. Lee left college to be married, and then it was goodbye Drew and hello Taos. I went to her wedding with hardly a qualm. Nice fellow, drove a Honda Civic. No problems there. I never had to worry about making the football squad. Drew doesn't even have a football squad. Instead, I took an extra class each semester and went to summer school for 2 years, in the time when I would have been sweating under the August sun, hitting the tackling dummies, if things had happened differently. As a result, I graduated early. 3 semesters early, in fact. If you met me on the street, you wouldn't notice a limp. But if you walked with me 4 or 5 miles, I do at least 3 miles every day as a matter of course. That physical therapy stuff sticks. You'd notice me starting to pull to the right a little bit. My left leg aches on rainy days. And on snowy nights. And sometimes when I have my nightmares, they're not so frequent now. I wake up, sweating and clutching at that leg, where there is still a hard bulge of flesh above the knee. But all my worries about wheelchairs, braces, and built-up heels proved thankfully hollow. And I never liked football that well anyway. Michael, Regina, and Arnie Cunningham were buried in a family plot in the Libertyville Heights Cemetery. No one went out to the gravesite but members of the family. Regina's people from Ligonier, some of Michael's people from New Hampshire and New York, a few others. The funeral was 5 days after that final hellish scene in the garage. The coffins were closed. The very fact of those 3 wooden boxes, lined up on a triple bier like soldiers, struck my heart like a shovelful of cold earth. The memory of the ant farms couldn't stand against the mute testimony of those boxes. I cried a little. Afterward, I rolled myself down the aisle toward them and put my hand tentatively on the one in the center, not knowing if it was Arner's or not, not caring. I stayed that way for quite a while, head down, and then a voice said behind me,
"Wanna push back out to the vestry, Dennis?"
I craned my neck around. It was Mercer, looking neat and lawyerly in a dark wool suit.
"Sure," I said. "Just give me a couple of seconds, okay?"
"Fine."
I hesitated and then said, "The papers say Michael was killed at home, that the car rolled over him after he slipped on the ice or something."
"Yes," he said.
"You're doing?"
Mercer hesitated. "It makes things simpler."
His gaze shifted to where Lee was standing with my folks. She was talking with my mother, but looking anxiously toward me.
"Pretty girl," he said.
He had said it before, in the hospital.
"I'm gonna marry her someday," I said.
"I wouldn't be surprised if you did,"
Mercer replied.
"Did anyone ever tell you that you got the balls of a tiger?"
"I think Coach Puffer did," I said. "Once." He laughed.
"You ready for that push, Dennis? You've been down here long enough. Let it go."
"Easier said than done."
He nodded.
"Yeah, I guess so."
"Will you tell me one thing?" I asked. "I have to know."
"I will if I can."
"What did..." I had to stop and clear my throat. "What did you do with the pieces?"
"Well, I saw to that myself," Mercer said. His voice was light, almost joking, but his face was very serious. "I had two fellows from the local police run all those pieces through the crusher out back at Darnell's garage. Made a little cube about so big."
He held his hands about 2 feet apart.
"One of those guys got a hell of a bad cut. Took stitches."
Mercer suddenly smiled. It was the bitterest, coldest smile I've ever seen.
"He said it bit him."
Then he pushed me up the aisle to where my family and my girl stood waiting for me. So that's my story, except for the dreams. I'm 4 years older, and Arnie's face has grown hazy to me, a Browning photograph from an old yearbook. I never would have believed that could happen, but it has. I made it through, made the transition from adolescence to manhood, whatever that is, somehow. I've got a college degree on which the ink is almost dry, and I've been teaching junior high history. I started last year, and two of my original students, Buddy Repperton types, both of them, were older than I was. I'm single, but there are a few interesting ladies in my life, and I hardly think of Arnie at all. Except in the dreams. The dreams aren't the only reason I've set all this down. There's another, which I'll tell you in a moment, but I would be lying if I said the dreams weren't a big part of the reason. Maybe it's an effort to lance the wound and clean it out, or maybe it's just that I'm not rich enough to afford a shrink. In one of the dreams, I'm back where the funeral service was held. The three coffins are on their triple bier, but the church is empty except for me. In the dream, I am on crutches again, standing at the foot of the central aisle, back by the door. I don't want to go down there, but my crutches are pulling me along, moving by themselves. I touch the middle coffin. It springs open at my touch, and lying inside the satin interior is not Arnie, but Roland D. LeBay, a putrescent corpse in an army uniform. As the bloated smell of gassy decay rushes out at me, the corpse opens its eyes, its rotting hands, black and slimy with some fungoid growth, grope upward and find my shirt before I can back away, and it pulls itself up until its glaring, reeking face is only inches from mine, and it begins to croak over and over again. "Can't beat that smell, can ya? Nothing smells this good except for pussy. Except for pussy. Except for pussy." I try to scream, but I can't scream because LeBay's hands have settled in a noxious, tightening ring around my throat. in the other dream. And this one is somehow worse. I've finished with a class or proctoring a study hall at Norton Junior High where I teach. I pack my books back into my briefcase, stuff in my papers, and leave the room for my next class. And there in the hall, packed in between the industrial gray lockers lining it, is Christine. Brand new and sparkling, sitting on four new white wall tires, a chrome-winged victory hood ornament tilting toward me. She is empty. But her engine guns and falls off. Guns and falls off. Guns and falls off. In some of the dreams, the voice from the radio is the voice of Richie Valens, killed long ago in a plane crash with Buddy Holly and J.P. Richardson, the big bopper. Richie is screaming La Bamba to a Latin beat, and as Christine suddenly lunges toward me, laying rubber on the hall floor and tearing open locker doors on either side with her door handles, I see that there is a vanity plate on the front, a grinning white skull on a dead black field. Imprinted over the skull are the words, "Rock and roll will never die." Then I wake up, sometimes screaming, always clutching my leg. But the dreams are fewer now. Something I read in one of my psych classes, I took a lot of them, maybe hoping to understand things that can't be understood, is that people dream less as they grow older. I think I'm going to be all right now. Last Christmas season, when I sent Lee her annual card, I added a line to my usual note on the back. Below my signature, on impulse, I scribbled, "How are you dealing with it?" Then I sealed the card up and mailed it before I could change my mind. I got a postcard back a month later. It showed the new Taos Center for the Performing Arts on the front. On the back was my address and a single flat line. "Dealing with what?" L. One way or another, I guess we find out things we have to know. Around the same time, it seems as though it's around Christmas that my thoughts turn to it the most often, I dropped Rick Mercer a note because the question had been on my mind more and more, gnawing at me. I wrote and asked him what had become of the block of scrap metal that had once been Christine. I got no answer. But time is teaching me how to deal with that, too. I think about it less. I really do. So here I am, at the tag end of everything, old memories and old nightmares all bundled into a neat sheaf of pages. Soon I will put them in a folder, and put the folder in my file cabinet, and lock that drawer. And that will be the end. But I told you there was something else, didn't I? Some other reason for writing it all down? His single-minded purpose. His unending fury. I read it in the paper a few weeks ago. Just an item that got put on the AP wire because it was bizarre, I suppose. "Be honest, Gilder," I can hear Arnie saying. So I will. It was that item that got me going, more than all the dreams and old memories. The news item was about a guy named Sander Galton, whose nickname, one would logically assume, must have been Sandy. This Sander Galton was killed out in California, where he was working at a drive-in movie theater in L.A. He was apparently alone, closing up shop for the night after the movie had ended. He was in the snack bar. A car ripped right through one of the walls, plowed through the counter, smashed the popcorn machine, and got him as he was trying to unlock the door to the projection booth. The cops knew that was what he was doing when the car ran him down because they found the key in his hand. I read that item, headed "Bizarre Murder by Car in Los Angeles," and I thought of what Mercer had told me. That last thing. He said it bit him. Of course, it's impossible. But it was all impossible to start with. I keep thinking of George LeBay in Ohio, his sister in Colorado, Lee in New Mexico. What if it started again? What if it's working its way east, finishing the job? Saving me for last. His single-minded
purpose. His unending fury.
Christine, a novel, was written by Stephen King and read by Holter Graham. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.